Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaberg Learning Consortium. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm William Satariano. I'm professor of epidemiology and community health in the School of Public Health at the University of California at Berkeley, and the moderator for tonight's program. Let me begin with a few words of introduction about our guest tonight, Dr. Walter Bortz, who is Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine in the School of Medicine at Stanford. Dr. Bortz is a graduate of Williams College and the School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He is one of the leading scientific authorities on aging and has written several best-selling books on that topic. His research focuses on the importance of physical exercise in the promotion of healthy or robust aging. I think it's impressive that Dr. Bortz speaks to both the research community and to the general public, and I might say with equal clarity and grace. He has published in prestigious journals such as the New England Journal of Medicine, the Annals of Internal Medicine, and the American Journal of Public Health, as well as the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, Town and Country, and Runner's World. It can be said of Dr. Bortz that he not only talks the talk, but walks the walk. In fact, if we were going to be completely accurate, we would say that he runs the run. An avid runner, Dr. Bortz runs 16 miles per week and has completed 36 marathons, including 40. Okay, well, this information is somewhat outdated. He was a little late for the program, so he may have just completed one of those marathons. But in his list of marathons, he completed the 2005 Boston Marathon and the 2008 New York Marathon. And there must be one that I've missed.
Boston.
Okay. So it's impressive. On his path to becoming expert in this field, Dr. Bortz has served as past co-chairman of the American Medical Association's Task Force on Aging. He is former president of the American Geriatric Society and is currently chairman of the Medical Advisory Board for the Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. He is also recipient of numerous awards, including the UCSF Institute for Health and Aging Distinguished Leadership Award and the Kenneth Cooper Award for Scientific Contribution to Active Living, and finally, the Presidential Award of the American Society on Aging. And I can go on and on. But we're really here tonight not to talk about Dr. Bortz, but to hear from him. So with that, please join me in welcoming Dr. Walter Bortz.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for coming. Before we go any further, to identify my shrimpy wife back there, with whom I've been hanging out for 57 years formally and 3 or 4 years informally before that. But she is the mother of our 4 kids, so I've caught her 4 times, you notice, and 9 grandkids. So that's a credential that I want to add to what has been said. I'm now 80 years old as of last week. And I ran the Boston Marathon 4 weeks ago. So that I don't want to discourage you and think this guy's a freak of some sort, because I'm not. And I would like to spend my time saying that we are all in this together. Mr. Jefferson was right that we're all created equal. We're all made of the same stuff. We're all schnapps, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur. We're all schnapps. We all play by the same biochemical rules, the Krebs cycle that goes back to bacteria. So we're the same. So we're the same at origin, but we're made different by how we live. One of my close friends was Norman Cousins. And Norman was precious to me because Norman cared about the power of thought and attitude. And I'm an absolute prisoner of the Serenity Prayer. Accept what you must, change what you can, but know the difference. So what that is so precious to me at this time of history is we've not known the difference until now. We've accepted too much, and we've not changed things we could. And the concretion of that reality was given in a wonderful summation legal report by Chief Justice Marie Garibaldi of the New Jersey Supreme Court, who was ruling in the matter of Farrell et al. Farrell was one of these unfortunate young women, I think she was 34 or 35, who had ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, that terrible disease that creeps up and you can't breathe. So she was being sustained by tubes, and she says, deliver me from this evil. I want to die. This is not life. So Marie Garibaldi, in her assenting opinion before the New Jersey Supreme Court, said, matters of fate have become matters of choice. And that is a riveting, riveting sort of summation of when we're alive. Until now, we have been fate. We've been passive ping pong balls in an air current, kind of getting tossed about. Now we're not. Now we know how long we can live, and we know the shaping elements. Norman, as I said to you earlier, was a close friend of mine, and I'm very proud of that affiliation. And Norman used to tell the story of Johnny. Johnny was a very dissolute student who was found by his ma one day over in the corner, kind of industriously toiling. And she was suspicious. She said, Johnny, what are you doing over there? I demand you tell me. Mama. If you have to know, I'm drawing a picture of God. Mother says, that sounds like something you would be doing because nobody knows what God looks like. And Johnny says, they will when I get through. So I offer to you the similar extrapolate that nobody has known what life has looked like until now. So we're the magnificent inheritor of a precious moment in history. The oracle at Delphi said, hold this truth most precious. Know yourself. Well, how the hell could you know yourself if you're dead when you're 20, 30, 40? If you thought that your cholera was due to sin, this is the way mankind, since Lucy, lived until the clarion moment in which science entered the picture was Louis Pasteur. Until Pasteur, an 1865 disease, was sin. And the church profited heavily by that nomenclature. But Pasteur says, it ain't sin, it's a bug. So it introduced the whole activist philosophy and potential to doing something that which is short-circuiting life. Louis Thomas, who was one of my real-life heroes, he was a very elegant physician out of Harvard. He ended up being chancellor of Sloan Kettering. He wrote a book called Medicine, the Newest Science. And you would not intuit that. But if you think critically, look at the other sciences. Astronomy, mathematics, go back to Babylon. Chemistry goes back to Lavoisier. Physics to Newton. Biology to Darwin. They have a very elegant pedigree, but we in medicine are just this young. We have not known what the hell we're doing, and I assert we don't now. The book that we're portraying tonight is called Roadmap to 100, and I'm very proud of it. And what it is, it's the science of aging. And I gave a talk in Philadelphia at the American College of Physicians in May of last year, called Geriatrics, the Gateway to Medicine. And what I meant by that is aging is not a disease. You can't cure it. It does not lend itself to cure, which is pills and surgery. So it demands that the entire embrace of the medical profession, if you care to allow that, must be changed. It must be reformulated. It must encounter a new definition. And in that regard, I referenced the important book written by Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N, who's the important historian of science out of the University of Chicago. He wrote 30, 40 years ago, a very important book. You should all have it in your libraries, called The Structure of Scientific Revolution. The Structure of Scientific Revolution by Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N. And in it, he says, whenever the populace recognizes that something's rotten in Denmark, it is their obligation to address it and to create a revolution. The case in point is the colonists in 1775. He said two prerequisites present when there is this necessity for revolution. Two prerequisites present. The first is there must be an agreement, a general agreement between the aggrieved parties. Virginia and Massachusetts had to get along. They could not be tugging at opposite ends of the argument. First prerequisite. The second is there must be an adequate replacement paradigm, being his word, a structure, to replace that which is rotten. And our colonists, our signatories of the Constitution, said the replacement paradigm is democracy instead of monarchy. So America was absolutely the byproduct of a Kuhnian formulation. Things were bad and we agreed, and we had a fabulous replacement paradigm that's still the best that the world knows. So I extrapolate that to medicine, to health. We've got a mess out there, and everybody agrees now. And Peter Orszag, who's now the head of OMB, was down at Stanford a while back, and I had a chance to engage him. And he said, until we get this medical thing worked out, you can forget the rest of the business of America. We cannot keep shoveling hundreds of billions of dollars down the rat hole, the black hole, because it's destroying everything. The state has as a first responsibility education. Education falters because it is broke from having to pay all these Medicaid bills. So we have this tension between other central elements of our culture and our physical and emotional well-being. So we have to resolve that. And I assert to you that the way to understand it is aging. When we understand a whole life, then we understand how to attack it. You can't understand a novel if you quit after the sixth chapter. You can't understand a ball game if you leave in the sixth inning. You get the point. We have to understand a whole life if we're going to design a formula to addressing that life. And we have not understood life and aging until now. And now, for the first time we do. Carl Sagan said, understanding is a form of ecstasy. So if I stand up here and appear kind of high, I admit that my endorphins are kind of bubbling because of an ecstasy of understanding what the hell is going on. So I'm a geriatrician. You've probably never even seen one of me before because there aren't many of us out there. We're a rare breed because there ain't no money in it. But I have been sheltered by that by being a member of the Palo Alto Medical Clinic and this cross-subsidization. All my surgical colleagues loved it. that I had all these old patients breaking their hips and obstructing and having cut. So that was a paycheck for them. So they cross-subsidized me. So I was able to get away with this wonderful life of being a geriatrician for low now 40-some years. And so I've been able to peer deeply into the lives, not momentarily, but over a span. So geriatrics demands new things. Instead of moments, which is medicine. Medicine is episodic, looking at this. Rally to the moment. Geriatrics denies that. It's looking at process over time. The second differentiating element of geriatrics is that it's not component, but it's system. Aging happens to us generically in toto. It's not our eyes, kidneys, liver, heart, bones, brain. It's the system. So it conforms a physician, science, to look at things in a totally different parameter. And a bunch of us put on a meeting at the NIH 3 or 4 or 5 years ago called The Dynamics and Energetics of Health and Aging. We had people from all over the world gave prep on these themes. We wrote a letter to the editor, to the chief of the NIH, Elias Zerhouni by name. And our first recommendation was close the Gene Institute. Heresy! What are you talking about? Francis Collins is about to be beatified. It's all genes. It ain't genes at all. This much genes. But it comes down to the fact that the ultimate diagnosis that I make in my coming book, Next Medicine, that's coming out, is a collision between biology and capitalism. What I mean by that is our biology, our health, the things that determine our well-being have been distorted by money. Medicine has gone, with Sutton's law, you go where the bucks are. So the big hitters in medicine are the technologists, the pharmacists, but do they affect life? And I did write an article in the Journal of the American Journal of Public Health called The Determinants of Health. And I think it's helpful. It makes the point that all health, from alpha to omega, is determined by an equation in which there are four exponentials. First is design. Second is accidents. Third is maintenance. And the fourth is age. Same as a car. If you're a Volvo or a Chevy, how long you're going to be running is determined by design, accidents, maintenance, and age. So let's go through them. Design, does design matter? If you're a lemon, you ain't going to get off the showroom floor. If you're defective out of the vaginal canal, you're not going to go long. But my friend at Berkeley, Stroman, said that only 2% of human illness is due to monogenetic problems. We're born damn near perfect. What slides out the birth canal is a byproduct of 250,000 generations of pruning. The ineffective products of this pruning didn't make it. So we are the byproducts of these genes that came out of 250,000 years of scrupulous scrutiny. So we're damn near perfect when we're born. So this whole fixation on genes is wrong. And it's very importantly wrong, and we've demonstrated. I went back to Washington. Back there, there's a cohort of twins. That's how you know how important genes are. You get identical twins. So if genes were dominant, then identical twins should die simultaneously of the same disease, right? Isn't that reasoning correct? That's the way it is. If you're an identical twin and that's what matters, then you should die the same moment of the same disease as your twin. Well, you look in this history, we got 10,000 pairs of genes we looked at. Identical twins die something like 7.3 years apart, rarely of the same condition. Non-identical twins die 7.9 years apart, and same birth date, non-twin die at 9.2 years apart. So you turn a biostatistician loose on that, and it turns out that genes are about 15%. Design is about 15%. So it does not say that heredity and ancestors don't matter. They matter a little bit. But back to the serenity prayer, you want to have things that matter that you can change, and you can't do nothing about your genes. You can't change your grandparents. And all this stuff, if you want to live a long time, choose old grandparents. It's cute, but it's wrong, because it leads to fatalism. Said, well, what the hell? I don't. All of my grandparents lived to be 106, and I love to jump out of planes without a parachute. I said, that's not a good idea at all. I don't think that you're immunized against what the world says. And conversely, if you say all my relatives died on their 40th birthday and I'm 39, I don't at that moment say good luck. I say, why did they die at 40, and what are you doing that puts you in a similar risk factor? So change what you can, accept what you must, but genes don't matter. I was referred to article out of Newsweek this week, and this damn dirigible, it's running around town, 23andMe, it's all, go in and have your buccal membrane, and we'll tell you whether you're going to get something. That's baloney, is a chief way of saying it, because it doesn't work. It's not right, but it's money. It's capitalism invading the biologic reality. So that's design. Does design matter? Yeah, a little bit. Next is accidents. Do accidents matter? Of course accidents matter. If you're getting run over by a truck or if you're driving over cliffs, accidents matter. So what do I mean by accidents with reference to ourselves? Well, accidents are those things that happen intercurrently of which we are but passive participants. Wars happen. Epidemics happen. Tidal waves happen. Starvation happens, and we're just watching, but it happens to us. And if you look at, there have been 181 billion homos since Lucy, and if you aggregate the chief cause of death, most have died of accidents, starvation, predation, like wild animals. Wild animals rarely have a chance to grow old. They grow old, die intercurrently, as we have until now. So that's accidents, the second determinant. The third is maintenance, and that's my theme. Maintenance is the action. That's where it is, and that's where the choice comes in, and that's where fate is excluded, because we can live life according to our design if we choose to. It has two components, like your car. Fuel, good fuel, not too much, too little. The main nutritional disease of not just America but the world now is obesity. I wrote an article for an Indian magazine today. They're going to have, I think, 100 million diabetics in India. What are you going to do? I mean, you think we got trouble. The Chinese, the same. I lectured in Beijing. They're catching our disease. And we don't have them, if you look to the medical profession, wherever it is, to solve that. It doesn't have anything whatsoever to do with it. I've started a program in Santa Clara County called Fit for Learning. Because it is said that every third kid now is going to get diabetes. Every other Hispanic and black kid is going to get diabetes. Diabetes shortens your life 15 years on average and costs $11,000 per person per year. So you take those statistics to the kids of Santa Clara County and say, what the hell, we can't afford that. And are the doctors going to do anything about that? Stanford isn't having to do with it. Parents do. Cutting out. Safe routes to school, cutting down TV watching. So we need a whole different paradigm that is not medical. So that's part of the maintenance, what you put in your mouth. But the part that occupies me and has really been my fun career has been how many RPMs go through this machine. And you can put too many through, and that goes by the name of stress. Stop the world. It's just going too fast. Chatter, chatter, chatter. Or too little, and that's mine. I wrote an article in the AMA Journal in 1982 called Disuse and Aging. It makes the point that most of what people think of as aging is not aging. It's disuse. Your arteries, your brain,
your pecker.
Everything deteriorates, not due to aging, but because it's not put in its correct atmospheric environmental interchange. And that's 30 years worth. A fit person of 80 is like an unfit person of 50, having nothing to do with genes, having nothing to do with doctors, pills, just how am I changing energy through this system on my arteries, my muscles, my bones, my pancreas, everything. It's choice, not fate. So that's maintenance. And finally, there's aging. Is there aging? Of course there's aging. Everything in the universe ages. Stars age, Chevys age, tadpoles age. We age. And aging is the second law of thermodynamics. Everything starts out as this highly organized concretion of matter, and it goes inevitably because of time and because of heat loss. We go from high order to low order, order out of chaos. We become increasingly chaotic. But there's an offset of 30 years by being fit. When you harmonize your gene set, every cell in your body has these genes. They're little switches that are listening. I read a blog called Exercise as the Oboe's A. I'm kind of a classical music nut growing up with the Philadelphia Orchestra. And before a classical concert, there's chaos down there. Everybody's fiddling and bashing and tweeting. And then the concertmeister comes out, and the oboe hangs, A, and everybody listens. And from that moment on, they're all on target. So instead of our genes just whittling away, they have to hear a signal. And the signal that our body wants is energy. It has antennae. Every one of our cells has receptor site antennae, protein molecules that are reconciling the environment with the self. We become what we do. I was talking at Harvard Medical School last year. A lady came out of the audience and said, Dr. Bortz, you like this? She says, you know, if who you are is what you are, if who you are is what you do, when you don't, you aren't. So doing and being are synonymous. Now, we have, unfortunately, kind of defaulted that to somebody else taking care of me. I have the chance to talk every year to summer's executive program at the Stanford Business School, and these guys come from all over the world to get rich. And I said, I don't want you to be rich. I want you to be healthy. My two questions are, what's the most important asset in your life? You got to answer health. I mean, there's no other. Second question, who owns that asset? Does Walgreens own that, or does Mills Peninsula or Diablo own? You own that. You're making decisions every day. How are you going to invest these receptor sites on your receptor sites? What energies are you going to run through this machine of yours? You can't buy it. It does not lend itself to a download. Within my coming book, which is called Next Medicine by Oxford Press, and it's really my magnus opus that I'm very excited about, it makes the point that you cannot download health. It's the locus of control. Who owns it? And none of us are responsible enough to see that. I was on CNN 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, and I was in the San Francisco studio on camera, and the hostess was in New York, and there she was on the monitor, and I was seeing her. And I was beating my chest about how we can live to be 100 and healthy and sexy, and I thought I did an okay job in my monologue. And she says, thanks, Dr. Bortz, that was really very nice. We appreciate what you said. She gives the mic to the lady in the front row. She says, Dolly, what do you think of what the doctor just said? She says, I don't believe a word he said. Said, these doctors are all so full of puff. Have you ever met an old doctor? All old doctors are dead, she said. She says, every time I feel like taking a walk, I lie down. And I love fat. And she showed abundant evidence of that. So Tilly had just revved the audience because she just punctured this pompous professor from Stanford. So they say to you, Dr. Bortz, what do you say to that? They said, what do I say to that? I said, as an American, I must respect the right of anybody to say anything they want, but immediately I would identify that rights come from responsibilities, and when you're not responsible, you forfeit the right. Dead air. Station break. I said, what did I just say on nationwide television that rights come from responsibilities? So I've now gathered that and think that that's profound. And it identifies again where we are. Until now, everything has been fate. We've had to pay for her abdication of health. That doesn't play anymore because now we know enough. We have come to the tipping point of knowing what health is. We can define health. Health is no longer a platitude. We know health at the molecular level. And I'm not going to pay for people that don't play by that rule. Now, I just had an exchange with Norman Daniels, and some of you might recognize his name. He's the big inheritor of the John Rawls social responsibility justice theme at Harvard, John Rawls and Norman Daniels. And I said, Norman, how do I deal with this woman who just thumbed her nose at me saying she doesn't pay attention to be health? Said, you got to go there. You have to agree because she doesn't know. She can't be held responsible. So you got to keep paying her bills. I said, I have come to the moment when I'm not going to do that anymore. I think it's time for us to grow up. I think our science has matured enough that people need to be responsible. So what I'm talking is not just cobwebs. It's science. We know the science of health. We know we can live to be 100. That's not a fancy or a Willard Scott curiosity. We know the details of it. We know how long a life can be, and we know what the shaping elements. So before I give vent to my final statement about life, I want to talk about death. Because as a geriatrician, I live with death. I wrote a paper called The Trajectory of Dying. And in it, I reviewed 97 deaths I had in the year 1997. I'd like you to believe that that's because of the patient population I took care of rather than my skills. But I got pretty close to death. And my solution to it is a good death is with no pain, no tubes, and no loneliness. That's a good death. But still, this whole idea of dying offends my vanity. My persona cannot really reckon with oblivion. Most people say that religion, classical religion, is founded on the need to gratify our fear of oblivion. And I think that's probably right. But I find trouble with the classical religious notions of redemption and reincarnation, particularly Buddhism. Did you, any of you see that wonderful PBS show on Buddha a while back? And it was glorious. But it did talk about if you live a good life, you'll come back as an elephant or as a butterfly or something. And it's lovely and poetic, but it strains my credulity. So I was struggling with that until I read a book by the name of one of my Stanford colleagues by the name of Irvin Yalom, Y-A-L-O-M. He was a psychiatrist, a brilliant man. He wrote a book called Staring at the Sun. And in Staring at the Sun, he talks about death. He says, when we die, our atoms, our carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, go off into the cosmic dust that was our origin. Inevitably, we must accept that as an origin. So our material sense goes off, no longer coherent. But what remains are the ripples of our life. And to me, that's just fabulous. That's changed my life, hearing that poetic estimation of our eternity. Because it conforms with everything else I believe about nature, that we are rendered coherent by the energetic interplay between us, our schnapps, and our environment. That's energy. So when we die, when I die, this corpus goes out someplace, but remain with my kids and my grandkids and you and readers of anything I write, Buddha, the ripples remain. And I like that. That feels comfortable to me. It feels scientifically accurate and conforms things that otherwise really we grapple with. So if we come back to Mr. Sagan telling us that understanding is a form of ecstasy, if we can package all of this, what is life, what is death, what's the meaning of life? People say, Dr. Bortz, what's the meaning of your life? And what's the meaning of my life? And I go back to Granddaddy Bortz, who is a butcher in Western Pennsylvania, and he used to say to me, Wally, go make yourself necessary. Now, what he meant by that was get the hell out of here. Get out from under feet. And so it didn't mean anything to me then. But now, at age 80, being necessary is it. If I'm not necessary in some context to my family, to my friends, to the world, to my... I'm feeding bluebirds these days. And I love it. Because they're coming around because I'm feeding them. So I have a certain bondage with my local bluebird society right now. But we should live. We should keep our foot down on the pedal of life as long as we have this interconnectivity, if there's relationships. When that goes, then it seems to me that's amen. And that's okay. I don't think we can have any argument with that. So I'm kind of lost in my time. I'm up here blabbering to the Commonwealth Club. How's my time going?
Well, I too am lost in space here. 25 minutes.
So I have 5 minutes to fill.
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you about my running the Boston Marathon. I'm not a runner. I'm terrible. I feel like I have army boots on when I run. But when I was 40, my father died, and my father was a big hitter. Dad was president of the AMA. He was Harvard. He was, I knew everybody. Paul Dudley White, Fran Lukens, Oxner, Leahy, Joslin. They were all my friends. They were all in my family home. So I grew up with a silver spoon in my mouth. Because of my father. And when Dad died, when I was 39, I was devastated. I'm an only child, and I'm sure I was clinically depressed. I couldn't write, sleep, work, do anything. So I did the only thing I knew how to do was to run, because I knew that exercise was a fabulous antidepressant. And there's good science behind that. When you exercise, your adrenaline goes up, and when you're depressed, you're catecholamines go down, so you're taking tofranil and all these damn pills that are really replacements for adrenaline, which is what happens when you run. So I started to run, and here I start trudging around the Bryn Mawr, where we were living there, in my underpants, and Ruthann thought it was inappropriate. But the Boston Marathon beckoned as the only world-class event that was open to klutzes, so I ran the Boston Marathon in 1971. On the 19th of April, I ran the Boston Marathon on the 19th of April, 2010, for my 40th consecutive annual marathon. Slow, dreary, and I hit the head of Boylston Street. Any of you know Boylston Street? Boylston Street is the final straightaway down into Copley Square and the finish line of the Boston Marathon. And I'd done 24 of the 26 miles quite equitably at my kind of pedestrian pace. But at mile 24, I had a gripe right back here, and my muscle back here just really grabbed me, so I became dysfunctional. So I was running around like this, and two young people came out of the audience, both Harvard MDs. Good choice. And so they were my rudder for the last 2 years, 2 miles of the run. They kept putting me on the center two yellow lines to keep me straight. So I hit the head of Boylston Street, and there's the finish line. And I had to circumnavigate a sweet street cleaner, Ponzoni. Those big old electrified something Bonzonis. So I had to go around that to get to the finish line. So meanwhile, my rudders were cheering, and it's Patriots Day in Boston, so there were people out drinking and celebrating. So I become a feature. And so they're screaming and hollering and tweeting and taking pictures, and I hit the finish line in 7.5 hours. And here's on NPR in Boston the next morning, my picture with the title, The Last Finisher. 35,000 start. And I then met me, I was either 34,999. But, you know, that of itself is a story, because we have a good friend, Ron Clark, who's one of the great runners of the world from Australia. And Ron told a story, says, the race of life goes not to the person who's first out of the gate, but to the person who slows down last. I said, right. I want to be not the guy, you know, the guy who won, it's a guy from Kenya, ran it in 2 hours and 5 minutes. So he could have lapped me twice. But if he had kept it up, he would have run 80 miles. He only ran 26 miles. So he was derelict in my judgment of it. I ran for damn near 8 hours, and I did. I mean, it was up and down. And I'm proud and honorable, and I seized my medal. I should have brought it tonight to portray to you all, but it makes a great story, and it gives me the chance to kind of leave you with Bortz's Law. And Bortz's Law says it's never too late to start, but it's always too soon to stop. Thank you very much for your attention.
Before we continue, I am to read the following. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking to Dr. Walter Bortz, renowned healthy aging expert, and author of Dare to be 100. And I'm Dr. William Satariano. I can't help but say that your description of The Last Finisher would be a wonderful subtitle for an autobiography. fortunately, we have a number of questions that have been handed to me from the audience, and I thought I'd actually begin with one of those questions. And it does relate somewhat to some of the last few points you've raised. And the question reads, is there any reason to think that healthy living will tend to result in a less miserable decline and death?
Well, I hope that that stood on its own merit. I've come lately, the last several articles I've written in journals were on frailty. Now, what is frailty? Frailty is not a disease. You can't admit a patient to a hospital with a diagnosis of frailty, but it kills you. So what is frailty? What it is, it's a system-wide in which everything goes to hell. And the reason for that is that which I spoke to you about before, all of your receptor sites and all your cells and all your organs are being inappropriately cued. They're not hearing the oboes A. So they're going down. So whether it hits your heart or your brain or your kidneys or whatever, there is then a final linkage that is most fragile. But frailty is that which responds to energetic stimulation. And it's the way nature, it's the second law of thermodynamics. And C.P. Snow says, anybody who's not familiar with the second law is equivalent to someone who's never read Shakespeare. So my wife hates the second law because I always talk about it. She thinks it's totally boring, totally opaque, and nobody gets it. But we should, because it contains a truth that is profound.
Let me ask one of my own questions. Your description of active seniors, both tonight and in your writings, including your own experiences as a marathon runner, are certainly inspirational. But are you concerned that at some point, for some older people, hearing those stories may actually have the opposite effect? Are you concerned that some people may be, in fact, intimidated, and even those stories would serve to justify sedentary behavior? How could I possibly reach this standard? So as a result, I'll stay on my couch.
Well, that's a fabulous question, and I think each of us has to reckon with that. I can't stand up and apologize for being fit, but I try to say that I'm just Joe Blow. I'm mm-hmm. not any gifted athlete at all. I've been gifted with a wonderful set of encounters through my life with great people and have taught me. And one of my statements that I think is meaningful is that the biggest killer is not cancer, heart, diabetes, it's health illiteracy. When people are literate about their lives, about how it works, then it'll all work. Then we're spending almost $2 trillion a year on nothing. When we get smart, we're not going to need to do that. We're going to take care of ourselves. So I hope I'm not evading that question, but you're right that one wants to set up an ideal, but it cannot be so many standard deviations off of what we comprehend. But I think there's science now, and I rely on that. This is not fanciful. This is real stuff.
How much exercise is the right amount? This is another question from our audience.
Well, thank you for that question. Ruth Ann and I spent 6 months in Africa with Richard Leakey. I'm kind of a pop anthropologist. And I wanted to see how much exercise did our ancestors do. When we all came out of Africa, all of our ancestors were, in effect, black athletes running after or away from something. And it turns out that if you look at the hunter-gatherers, I spent my 51st birthday with a bushman on the Kalahari. They hunt 3 times a week. It's what gratifies their caloric need as being a nuclear family, a male, a female, and 4 to 6 kids. So you need to hunt 3 times a week to get enough stuff to bring that home. That comes down to us in terms of a frequency of exercise. We know in terms of exercise physiology that we must go 3 or 4 or 5 times a week in which we take this carcass and stretch it. So we cannot be on idle. A system needs to go into some gear before it converts into a structural response to exercise. So the short answer is, I parrot from all the other authorities, say 3 to 5 times a week, half hour minimum, in which time you're sweating, in which you're panting a little bit. Just a casual walk is better than sitting, certainly. But in order for us to stretch the arteries, stretch the brain, stretch the muscles, you got to put a little bit of a workload on that for the DNA to hear the challenge.
Very good. Another question from the audience. People from what countries are most likely to live to 100 years in great numbers, and why? So that's a diversity question, global diversity.
Well, it's a wonderful thing, and I study it. There's a recent book out, I guess it was sponsored by the National Geographic, called Blue Zones. And I think this guy, he's made quite a thing, and there's a book out, and National Geographic has espoused it. What are they? Sardinia and Hunza and some places in northern Italy. They use the Seventh-day Adventists in Loma Linda. So they aggregate.
So it's not just wine. In other words, okay.
Well, I one of my favorite sidelights is the article that came out in the National Geographic 10 or 20 years ago, written by Alexander Leaf, who is the chief medical officer to Mass General Hospital, a credential above which there's none other in all medicine. And Dr. Leaf had a sabbatical, and he says, well, I think it'd be kind of fun to go look at these population groups that were reputed to be long-lived. And he went to Hunza in southern Pakistan, to Russia and to Georgia and Russia, and Vilcabamba, Ecuador. And he went over there and took a National Geographic photographer with him and took these pictures, and it came out in the National Geographic. Those super centenarians, and here's Ivan Medov, and Ivan's 196, and he's up taking care of his. And here's Minnie Minoza smoking her pipe, taking care of her great-grand. She's 181. We thought, oh, my God, what an article. It's Shangri-La. There's places in the world in which people are living on and on into these spectacular ages, sheltered as they are. And unfortunately, it was wrong, because the scholars went marching in, as they're prone to do, and set Minnie and Ivan down and said, let's go through this. So the Guinness Book of World Records says there's no other portion of the human existence that's so prone to exaggeration as that of longevity, because people claim exalted social status by being very old. You're 187, let me take your picture. So they all got a few years older by the time he came back. But we now know, and that's the point of this. As recently as 25 years ago, a big deal expert claimed there were 180-year-old people because he didn't know. That mistake will never be known, be made again, because of Madame Calmont. Madame Calmont was in our literature. I met her doctor. They used to report to us about her well-being at our meetings. And she died at 122 2/3. Sprightly. My favorite story about her was the French habit of viager, V-I-G-E-R. And viager specifies that circumstance in which a younger person can assume the mortgage of an older person, so that when the older person dies, this guy gets the mortgage. Well, this poor guy in Paris assumed her mortgage when she was 79 or something. And so he's long embalmed, and she's still riding her bike around. So it shows you can't count on that. So anyhow, that's in my book, Dare to Be 100, I draw a map of life, and we now know what the horizontal, as of today, is Madame Calmont. Ken Manton, who's our leading age demographer at Duke, says there are probably people alive 130 who will be 130. So that's the horizontal of life. Now, that's important to know, but I do not want you to think that you're going to be 130 or 120 or 110, because life, like all biology, is a bell-shaped curve. Mm-hmm. And I claim that 100 is the middle of the bell. I don't think that is an exaggeration. I don't think that's blowing smoke. I don't think that's a folly. I think that if you ever look at your birth certificates, on the other side there's an expiration date. And it's 100 years from your birthday. So expect it. Plan on it.
Let me ask you another diversity question. This is less global, and we can actually even talk about the Bay Area. Not surprisingly, older people are more likely to walk and be active in places where they feel safe from heavy traffic, speeding cars, and, of course, safe from crime. They're also more likely to be active in neighborhoods with well-maintained sidewalks, where they have access to parks, and also in places where they can easily walk from their homes to the market, post office, other services. So we have those places. But we also have other places. And what about the people who live in those places, the places that aren't safe, that do not have the good sidewalks, where there are fewer easily reachable destinations? What can we do about the old people who live in those places?
Well, that's a wonderfully probing and sensitive and real question. In my book, Coming, I assert that we know where we are and we got these problems. And to get there, we have three things. IOI, information is the knowledge. O, opportunity is the chance to put the knowledge to effect. So we know that exercise, we know walking. But if you are born into it, and there's tremendous health disparities in America, and I'm ashamed of that. If Mr. Jefferson says we're born equal but made unequal by our culture, that casts us all in an immoral stance. So I think we have to address that, and I coined the term common health. So common health is not doctors. If you look at the spectrum, doctors and medicine have maybe 10 to 15% to do with how well and how long you're going to live. It's mostly the common health. It's schools. It's where you live. It's your job. It's how you have your stress management. Mm-hmm. And those are not anything that I learned in medical school. These mm-hmm. are things that must be in knowledge. But finally, IO, information opportunity, is another I, which is incentive. Now, I'm enough of a capitalist to say that America lives on money. And my solution to reformulating the healthcare system is to pay for health instead of disease. What we have now is a disease system. It's repair. We get paid for repair. Every prescription I write, every test I order, every operation, that's a country club payment. We can't do that. We've got to pay for health. And now we know what health is. And without very much technology, I can take a swab and predict how long you're going to live. And I think you should be charged by that. I think my adversary on the show should pay more. Well, that's not going to happen today. But it's going to happen eventually because it's risk adjustment. All of us believe in insurance. Ben Franklin started it in Philadelphia in 1770 to share the fire risk. So we all have risk of things happening to us. So we need a system that protects us against. But what about the 60, 70% of illness that's self-inflicted? Are you going to pay for suicide? I don't feel like that. So in order to get to where we need to be, you need science. And I'm very excited to think that we now have a basis on which to allocate resources and needs.
Mm-hmm. I know you think of aging as a lifelong process. It's not something that we start to think about at age 55 or 65. And I'm just wondering about your reaction to some recent statistics that suggest that current cohorts of children will have a shorter life expectancy than their parents and grandparents, due in large part to what some people have referred to as the obesity epidemic.
Right. Well, thank you for it. That's a very, very emphatic statement. Yes, verily. In the New England Journal of Medicine, J.L. Shansky from Chicago said that we as a nation are now facing the prospect of our kids living less long as the parents. Now, if that doesn't get your attention, what does? I mean, and it's not due to genes. Our genes are perfect. They've been perfect for a long time. They're all due to the environment, and we're emphasizing that inappropriately. So we're getting smarter, and there's a very real orientation between longevity and health and intelligence. So as my hope is that our health illiteracy is sponged out. I think we ought to we're spending almost $2 trillion a year in America on health care. If I'm the czar, I'll take half of that right out of the medical system and give it to education. Public education at every stage. Educate us. Let us be smart. Let us know what health is. To me, it's the most important asset, and it will be made more manifest as we understand it.
Let me ask you, I think, a related question in a somewhat of an indirect way, but this comes from the audience. What are your thoughts on assisted suicide?
I'll vote against it because we're intrinsically too mischievous. I have seen situations in which cousin Will covets Uncle Henry's farm and says, "Doc, don't you think he's kind of losing it?" And we could usher Uncle Will along if we allowed that to happen. So I resist it officially, but I sanction it personally. and I've personally done it many times. But you do it always with full information, with family, with patient. And I think you should live long enough to be necessary and to extinguish the joy in your life. When you no longer reckon to a morning, a Christmas morning, with kids in the acclaim, and you're numb to that, then life is over. And so we must mature as a society to say, when is it okay to die? Now, there's a little couplet that says, thou must not kill, but needs not strive officiously to keep alive. Now, I've been very involved in this dying stuff at official levels. As president of the American Geriatric Society, I came upon the era in which if you died without every heroic effort being made, pounding your chest, paramedics, tubes, the state would come in and investigate, why did you let this person die? Well, that was horrendous. But we've moved them along. Now we recognize, even the Pope in an encyclical says that allowing people to die is not so horrible. So we must get matured. What is life? What are its essences? What's the meaning of life? Are we sustaining a life that's worthy or not? I have a friend by the name of Dan Callahan, who was the head of the Hastings Institute in New York, and he characterized two kinds of deaths, a tame death and a wild death. Now, the wild death he characterizes is almost always medicalized with tubes. The tame death is at home with family. And so we, again, must mature ourselves to setting in place opportunities to do that. And the doctor's part of that, but not exclusively. So the first admonition, thou shalt never hurt. And I look at my deteriorating patient, I promise you, that you're never going to have pain. I will give you morphine until you turn into a crystal of morphine. So you're not going to hurt. And so that takes a lot of this argument out. A lot of us are afraid of dying a wild death in which we're no longer there to participate in it. But if the physician and the care system can assure me, you, that your death will be at your election. And I love these morphine pumps that the person has the trigger themselves. Take what you need, fella, and I'll be there to fill the bottle up when you need it.
If you looked away for a moment and then looked back and saw President Obama sitting here instead of me, what would you say to him?
Go for it. I am a fervent Obamaphile. I love him. I've met him. He absolutely swarmed me with his charisma. And he's right. Everyone says he's overextending himself. He's charging too much. He's creating too many obligations for us. I want my president, I want our government to be daring. I'm assaulted by this financial mess, which has hurt and continues to hurt us all, was for lack of regulation, selfishness, greed. And that's been allowed to go. And I was born a staunch Republican. Conservatives could be, I've kind of flipped over and said, we need to care for our common people. And I salute Obama and his wife, Michelle. She's now taken on this childhood obesity thing. And I wrote a blog today praising her for that leadership. So if you are President Obama, I said, go for it, man.
Well, we've reached the point in the program where there's time for only one last question. And I thought I couldn't think of a more appropriate person to ask you a question than you. What question do you think is of most significance that you'd like to leave this audience with?
Well, thank you. That's very probing and real. And I have a bunch of groupies around. And they look at me and they say, what does success look like? What would you like if you shut your eyes and could transform the world? Well, I guess it really does come down to answering the information part, opportunity part, and incentive part. If all of those mechanisms were out there, then I think it's all downhill. we're paddling upstream against money, and we have to change that around, a Kuhnian revolution. We must change the paradigm to health from illness. I would love to direct you to a website that is mine, which is walterbortz.com, and has a lot of the papers that I've written and the books that I've got, and I've started blogging, which is a strange thing. I never heard the term. But my kids are all saying, you got to go there, Dad. So it's fun, and I love being with you all, and I love the Commonwealth Club. And I talked in the city, and they taped it, and it's a really good tape. So I recommend it. It's on my website. Thank you for coming all.
Yes. So our thanks to Dr. Bortz, and we also want to thank the Lafayette Library and Learning Center and our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Dr. William Satariano. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is the place where you're always in the know, is now adjourned.